okay, the room just filled up like that. Blink and ta-da! There you all are. How nice to see you all again. Yes, week two of Becoming Your Best Self. If you have forgotten your books, that's okay. There's always spare booklets and pens and things over there. Oh, good. Oh, excellent. Because I'm going to see how you went with the reflection sheets and things. So just as a kind of a refresher of what we've covered so far, three levels of happiness. Do you remember what they were? Lower happiness, middle happiness. Sounds like second breakfast, lunch. the first level, the lower happiness, well, it's what we get from the world, or hedonic happiness, so from the senses. And it's not actually that one type of happiness is better than another. We need all three types of happiness, because if we don't have enough food, or if all the food that we eat is just like grey slop, it's not conducive circumstances. So there's nothing wrong with it, but it's just got a drawback, which is it ends, that's right, or it flips over into its opposite. Delicious cheesecake, more delicious cheesecake, fourth slice of delicious cheesecake. Now it's like, I'm never eating cheesecake again. There's what we bring to the world, the eudaimonic happiness, how we contribute, and how that gives us a really strong sense of well-being and self-worth. And the third one, the happiness of the stages of enlightenment. So it's much more, it's not dependent on external circumstances. And so it's about us changing. It's us releasing our negativities and bringing our qualities to fruition. No, it's not saying that. It's having all of the causes of happiness there, so you can't help but have the result. And the causes aren't from out there. If it's from out there, it's always secondary. B. Alan Wallace said this really fantastic thing. It's like, we think the happiness is in the thing, but it's not. The happiness is in our capacity to enjoy the thing. Yes, it's how we frame the world, of being able to keep our mind calm and content, and then everything brings us happiness. And so not having any value judgment about one's better than the other, it's just that we put all of our, or most of our energy into the hedonic happiness, thinking the happiness is in the thing, and of course it never works, and so we waste so much effort and we have so much disappointment. And no one wants to be disappointed. So attachment to the hedonic happiness distracts us from a deeper flourishing. It even just distracts us from, doing what matters to us. So that's actually what we'll be looking at today. But before we get there, so the homework reflection sheets. Did anything stand out to anyone? You said you were writing. Did anyone else write their stuff down during the week? Yeah. Anything stood out? Anything that you'd like to share from it? From either the gratitude journal or even just the first ones of what qualities you'd like to develop and what problems you'd like to overcome? Or a question. So with the gratitude journal, did anyone have a go at the gratitude journal? Yep. And so what are some of the things you put in there? Yeah, relational things. That's right. And it makes a big difference in your life, doesn't it? And if we don't have our friends or partners or pets, then we're lonely. So yeah, yep. And so of course it's really good to recognize that and really appreciate and value them, because what do they say? Familiarity breeds contempt. It's like we start taking things for granted and then end up accidentally mistreating people and things. So yeah. Yes, well, it depends. Often it starts off as the hedonic happiness that we just like hanging out with people. And that's usually like the honeymoon period, isn't it? And then something happens. There's like a bonding experience or a challenge or some embarrassing thing happens. And you either like never see each other again, or because you've kind of revealed yourself, you become closer. And so that's getting more into that second level of happiness of the, of being honest, of letting go of the, you know, the stupid things, of caring about the other person's well-being, putting them first, all of those things. That's what happens. I mean, there's countless movies about it, isn't there? About this make or break moment. So it can go all the way through, but if it just stays on the hedonic happiness, then it's just like, you know, me and my drinking buddies. When I stopped drinking, I stopped having buddies, basically. Oh, great. Me too. I'm grateful for Langri Tang Center as well. Oh, boy. And to my mother, who started it, who I wouldn't be here otherwise. So thank you. It's like having two lives, you know, the human life and then the good life. Coffee. Oh, absolutely. Coffee's on your list too. So, yeah. So I must admit, with coffee, I've piggybacked my meditation onto having my morning cup of coffee, because I'm pretty erratic with things. But one thing I always do is have a cup of coffee. So I figured that's how I'm going to meditate. Is the thing that I'm always going to do. I'm going to hitchhike the meditation to it. So I do my prayers over my coffee, and then there's a bit where you have the light flowing through you and kind of purifying things, and that's about when the caffeine's hitting. It's just like perfectly timed, so it's not quite kosher, but yeah. The telling thing is, if you can still have a good morning if you miss your coffee. Yes, coffee, cat and computer are the things that I often have. But what about things that you felt grateful for that weren't to do with the things, with the senses, but were more like the relationship things, like more a little bit deeper, the inner world? Do you have anything of those? Gratitude journal? That is a fantastic example, because that really is, it's a giving back thing. Teaching little kitties jujitsu, yeah. And then... yeah, so then there's a sense that you feel inside with doing that, isn't it? It's not just a job, and whether the kitties fail or whatever, it doesn't matter. It's that contributing. No, well, it's interesting you bring that up. So seeing kids just flourish and be kids, and that kind of, you know, just joy that they can have, or even just being helped. So there's a way that we have this real sincerity of really appreciating their development. And then there's a way that we can, without knowing it, slightly corrupt it, because we start relying on that so we feel good. So it's flipped over from focused on them to focused on me. And that's where it does become diminishing returns or gets corrupted. And that's actually what we're going to look at today, because a lot of those things that we love doing that really matter to us, we unintentionally corrupt them. Not because we're bad, but just because what comes in are what are called the eight worldly concerns. So it's like we lose the big picture. And so the worldly concerns, meaning the unstable concerns, is what ruins all of our good intentions and ruins what really matters to us. And it's what distracts us. Where we might have something that we really love doing that really matters to us, that nourishes us, and yet we get distracted. How does that happen? So this is what we'll look at. And part of it is about how cognitive confusion enslaves us. And then what do we do? The power of setting a good intention. So has anyone heard that term, cognitive fusion? Yeah, so that's that. It's very associated with that thought of the happiness is in the thing, where we fuse how something appears to how it is, and it's not necessarily like that. But let's start with a meditation, this time a feeling tone meditation, to set the scene. So we can adjust our physical posture first. So the two-point posture is to have a straight back and a relaxed body. So getting comfortable in the chair, making sure that you're sitting well back in the chair so your lower back is supported. Try and have your feet firmly on the floor so that you feel stable, symmetrical. If it's comfortable, hands in your lap, right palm on top of left with the thumbs lightly touching. Allow yourself to become stable and grounded. And then gently bring your focus inwards. Just become aware of rising and falling of the breath. Adjust your spine so it's fairly straight. Pull the shoulders back a bit so the heart and chest area opened up. You can breathe freely. Your head just slightly tilted forward with the chin tucked in. All the muscles of the face relaxed. Tongue on the upper palate behind the top teeth. Eyes with a little bit of light coming in. And as you let your focus just rest gently on the breath, notice your feeling tone. How do you feel at this moment? So notice it as if you were a reporter, not judging it in any way, just becoming aware. You might be feeling a pleasant feeling tone, sitting here at ease. Or is it a feeling tone that's somewhat unpleasant, maybe a bit agitated or restless? Or even as nothing's happening in this moment, you feel a bit bored. If you do feel a bit bored, then you can use this neutral feeling tone to rest in the calming rhythm of the breath. You're feeling quite buoyant and happy. Try to experience these feelings without grasping at them, wanting more, or worrying that they'll disappear. Just simply enjoy the moment in a relaxed manner. With each in-breath, appreciate the feeling. With each out-breath, release them into the world. So if you're feeling a little low and grey, try to accompany that feeling with compassion. Without any need to sink into it or identify with it, but also without needing to push it away. Recognize you're not reducible to any one feeling. You're not your negative mind states. So experience that slight feeling of being a bit low with kindness and compassion. And notice how you feel it in the body. How does it feel in the solar plexus? The texture of the feeling. Let it flow through you without fighting it, just relaxing the whole body. If you become aware of the feeling tone, just notice and name. If you do notice any storyline in the mind that accompanies that feeling, see if you can let go of that storyline. Just simply being aware of the feeling tone in a non-judgmental way. Sitting with that feeling with kindness. So in this spaciousness and stability, we can set our motivation, recognizing that we're all in the same boat. We all have feeling. We all matter, every one of us. And so we can set our motivation to bring peace and happiness to every one of us. And then to be able to do that, then that's why we're engaging in the class. So then you take a nice deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. Gently bring your focus back to the room. Why we bite the hook? What distracts us from the happiness that we seek? So we all want to have a sense of peace and calm and fulfillment in our life, and yet it's so easy to get distracted. And you blink and years go by. And I've found that even coming to Lungri Tungpa Center, that I blink and I think, oh, I haven't been to Lungri Tungpa Center for a while, and it's been a very long time. So that was before I was here as the program coordinator, and now luckily I'm stuck here. So, but really what distracts us is what's called preoccupation with worldly matters, meaning all the things that are unstable, that are short-term, unreliable. And because these are all the things that we spend a lot of our time trying to control, even though we can't control them. trying to make things work for us, trying to get ahead, trying to get a career, get reputation, get our life in order, and then stuff happens, doesn't it? Just put us off track. And in amongst all of that striving, we lose sight of what really matters to us. So we end up being cranky with the people that we love, or we end up spending a lot of time in resentment instead of actually enjoying this incredible situation that we're in. We start focusing on how much we lack. And why we're biting the hook all the time like this is because we're enslaved by cognitive fusion. So this means we instinctively judge the worth of our experience by the momentary emotional sensation. And this gets us every single time. So for instance, if it feels bad, we just instinctively want to avoid it. Feels bad. And if it feels good, then it must be good for us. And there are so many things that are not like this. I mean, the obvious one I come back to all those years that I was a drinker. So feels good, makes me feel, means that I can go out, I can communicate with people, I'm not shy anymore, I was a happy drunk, you know, all those things. And so then I thought it was good because it felt good. But of course, then it became toxic after a while. So then I turned into a nasty drunk. And other things too, if something feels unpleasant, then we try and avoid it. So we avoid often a lot of things that are going to be beneficial to us, like avoid going to the doctor or avoid going to the dentist. At our peril, especially with the dentist. So a lot of this, we pride ourselves with being quite rational, and yet a lot of our decisions are made just purely on feeling, of an emotive feeling, and they're really inconsistent. So I noticed this with friends, that so when I was a drinker, I would spend time with people that were fun. So it felt good, and then it was fun. But actually, then I looked, there's so many years that were just wasted in partying. It wasn't good. It was like, I've got nothing to show for it. And then I stopped drinking, and then I discovered how difficult I am, and then I discovered, actually, friends that were left are also quite difficult people. And so it was this really weird balance of like, my best friends are really hard to be with. But they care about me, they look after me, they understand me, and they're honest with me. So there's a tension there, isn't there? We tend to just like being with people that agree with us, that make us feel good, that have all the same views as us. And so I've got friends like that are really easy to be with, but actually they're not very ethical people. They just happen to be really easy to be with. And so I thought they were friends because it was just enjoyable. So you can see. So cognitive fusion is where we believe the appearance. We fuse the emotion about it, the story, to the thing. And where this plays out is with the eight worldly concerns, which are four pairs of things. So the most obvious one is where we just instinctively seek everything that's pleasurable and avoid everything that's painful and uncomfortable. So we're attracted to interesting events, and really happy when things go well, when things are easy, and we're averse to boring things or unpleasant things or painful things or things that take effort. Just as a general kind of thing. And this really backfires on us. So with the dentist one, so many times you can, and I've done the same thing where I've had incredible toothache and being frightened and going to the dentist, and then by the time you go, they say, you should have come in months ago, then we could have saved the tooth. And now this one's probably the one that gets us all the time. The reason I've put chocolate cake in there is because of that thing of just overeating anything that's delicious. I also notice that in Dharma classes, that if you have all the classes to do with kindness and love and everything, they're very popular. The class to do with death and rebirth, or death and dying, no one comes to. Until someone's died, and then they're like, quick, what do I do? And like, you can't say, oh my God, like you should have come to the class. So this is this thing, we just recoil from the unpleasant. We somehow put it off. And yet, anything to do with death and dying, that's guaranteed we're all going to experience. With ourselves, with our pets, with our loved ones, that's the one guarantee, isn't it? And yet, it's like, no, 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 don't want to know about it. And so the long-term consequences then are quite severe. There's a lot of suffering that comes from putting it off and putting it off. And if you've ever been, have any of you been to Let's Have a Chat About Death on Sundays with the nuns? It's so fun because you sit in the lounge, very comfortable. You can just have a meandering conversation and you can ask those things that you're kind of hesitant about with someone that is completely relaxed and not fearful. And then have an experience of what it's like to talk about death and dying not as a bad thing. That's quite amazing. There's another here. Where we seek gain and we avoid loss. Yeah. I thought I'd put that in because, I mean, the amount of money that the guys spend on trying to stop balding is like, it's huge. I mean, we're always bagging women for spending money on cosmetics and what are the facelifts and things like that. But guys spend as much money on the balding. But why we put this in is that not just on treatments, but on scams. So this is this thing, because why really intelligent people get scammed. It's not that you're not smart or that you're a loser when you get scammed. And the amount of scammers in Australia and how much money, how many millions each year gets lost to scams is because of these worldly concerns. So you get hooked by something, you get hooked once, and it's an escalating thing. You pay the money, $5 to open the account so you can get the great big windfall, and then they're like, no, I need another $5 to cover the whatever. And so the whole time while you're still paying the money, in your mind, it's still a possibility. But the moment you go, I've been scammed, you have to face the fact that you've lost the money. So that's why the scammers know. They just got to get you once and you will just keep paying the money more and more and more, because we're averse to loss. We'd rather believe that it's going to happen. Apart from just the allure of a bargain, buy six, save, you know, whatever. So all of these things, advertising is incredibly clever because it doesn't work on logic or intellect. It works on our emotions, and they are inconsistent. And they get us every single time. So we don't like things deteriorating. We don't like losing our stuff. I've done this with buying shoes. I've bought cheap shoes how many times that just fall apart? Don't want to spend the money. That, I think it's called a false economy. And then the aversion of not wanting to lose anything. So I was just recently reading a story of someone getting mugged, and the robbers were like, give me your wallet and your rings. And they're like, no, you're not having my ring. And so they were shot. So you've got, you value your stuff. Like, no way, you're not getting my ring. At the expense, instead of just, here you are, whatever you want. So it makes sense so far. Can you see how it's like, it's really deep. It's not a decision that we make. We're pushed around by this, and it derails our life, these kinds of things. There's a couple more. So praise and blame, seeking admiration, approval, being agreed with, encouraged, recognized, flattery. So again, if someone flatters you, you're very likely to do anything for them. We're so hungry for admiration and approval. And a lot of the scams online with chat rooms and the grooming comes from that, of just being listened to. We're so vulnerable of needing to be appreciated and listened to, that just someone going through the motions will just open up like that. And then blame, or being criticized, denigrated, put down. When someone does that to us, we take it as if that's true. So instead of thinking, well, if they're criticizing and abusing me and it's true, then thank you very much. It's better to know, isn't it? And if it's not true, why worry about it? It's like saying, oh, you know, Nikki, you've got a blue nose. Like, how very dare you? No one says that to me. Like, no, I don't. No problem. But we put a lot of store into the approval of others, as if that makes us what we are. So when someone criticizes us or gets us wrong, misinterprets us, we find it unbearable. And I noticed this actually with reading stories about rich people. Rich people have surround themselves with yes men, with people that agree with them. And so they have no friends. They have no one to actually help them or tell them what's what or look after them or care about them. Just everybody just agrees with them. It's such a vulnerable, dangerous place to be in. And you can go so off the rails. But it's because we can't bear being criticized. Yeah, I think the moment that we become aware of them, make them conscious, they stop bullying us. But yeah, but you still have the pull of it. But the cognitive fusion has the pull and believes the story. So you can still have the pull of like, oh gee, I'd love a second, third, fourth thing, cheesecake, but at the same time not believe it and just go, ah, there's that current. So you stop being pushed around. Success and failure as well. So I led this course I can't remember which university it was, just for the student body, the postgrad students, because they were all in this kind of syndrome of like, what is it called? Imposter syndrome. You know, so quite a lot of pressure and quite a lot of competition, and everybody trying to big note themselves and terrified that they'll be found out. And so here they are doing these, you know, this postgrad study on things that they love, their vocation. One of them was violin player, and all the joy had gone out of playing violin because it had been usurped by these worldly concerns. And so the instead of just like trying to do your best making this most beautiful music, now it's like got to get the kudos from others. What if somebody didn't like it? the competitiveness. And so they lost track of why they loved playing the violin in the first place. And so then what started off as following your dream ended up being just corrupted, bullied by all these things. And so not having courage to play the pieces that they wanted to, not being happy with their own best efforts. So this one of success and failure really comes in as well, because thinking that it's the success comes from out there, from the people out there, rather than your own internal measure of success. And then being beholden to having the reputation and being acknowledged. Flattering self-image, being well-known, good status, and a total fear of failure. So that's a big one, isn't it, in our culture. A fear of failure stops us doing the things that we really love doing. It'll stop people investigating a line of research that might change the whole course of medicine or history just because you don't want to look like a fool. So here you are, you've got your internal values, what matters to you, and at the same time, you can't do anything because you don't want to look like an idiot. It's a tragedy. So how come we get distracted like this or derailed like this? Because you're absolutely right, we're not aware of these huge currents. So there's reasons why we are dominated and bullied by these worldly concerns. And that goes a lot down into Buddhist psychology of the nature of our mind and who we grasp as who we are, and how most of how who we feel we are comes from outside of us. So I noticed this when I was living in Melbourne. I was living in East St Kilda, so it's this Orthodox Jewish suburb. And what was really funny was, whenever I walked down the street, I'd be completely ignored, like I just did not feature as a human being. But not because I had punk hair and whatever. It was just because I was a Gentile. And I was super happy about that, because the whole rest of Melbourne, I was discriminated against for having weird hair and clothes. But here I was discriminated against because I was a Gentile. So I was like, yeah. But so there was that. But then I also noticed how weird it is to be invisible, to be unacknowledged as a human being. It really is quite confronting. Who am I then if I'm not reflected by others? So then we become really beholden to others reflecting us in the way that we like. So there's a funny story about the success and failure that I read in the New Yorker about the American Army doing various exercises about terrorists coming, and so they had their little war games, and so half the army group was going to be the terrorist invaders and the other half was going to be the defenders, and they had their exercises. And so the general that was in charge of the play-acting terrorist group thought, okay, well, what do guerrilla warfare and terrorists do? They just break all the rules. So he started his incursion the night before. And the others were doing everything by the book and by the rules. And so, of course, they were roundly trounced. Whatever they did, the guerrilla kind of warfare guys, overwhelm them. It was very embarrassing. And so, of course, what happens afterwards when they present the results and go, this is all of our vulnerabilities, right? This is, no invader's going to tell you what time they get. 9 o'clock, we'll do it. And so then what do you think happened? The general that was to do with the guerrilla warfare, he was just sacked. And they were made to run the whole thing again with good results. So this is how, if you actually want to defend a country, you've got to look at the failures, isn't it? But if you're averse to failures, now suddenly, now you're really bullied by this, the worldly concerns. And this happens all over the place. It happens with all the cover-ups in the hospitals and the medical industry because it's too embarrassing to have a failure. And so they forget that the whole point of having a hospital is to save lives. And so it's not that the administration's malicious or anything like that, but they've been co-opted by these worldly concerns and forgot what the whole point of having a hospital. Yeah, and when a politician does say, I made a mistake, we'll try and make it better, it's outrageous, isn't it? It's very refreshing. And I mean, there are politicians like that, but they don't get nearly enough publicity, in my view. Yeah. A lot of people where you read about following a line of research or making various inventions, you know, so many failures for so many years. And I look at those stories and just go, wow, you know, to have that perseverance to get through while everyone's saying and your family's against you, you're wasting your time, that kind of thing. So similar thing happened on a much smaller scale here at Lungri Tampa Centre when we were looking for this building. We're looking for a bigger building. We're in my mother's house, still in a tiny, tiny little squishy lounge room. And so I thought we have to get a bigger place. We've run out of room. Yet we've got no money, no income, no savings, no nothing. But I just thought we've got to do everything that we can, get all our ducks in a row, just in case a miracle happens, something amazing happens. So we did lots of research. I developed a huge business plan, did all the cost-benefit analysis, market, blah, 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 the whole thing. And people were saying to me, Miffy, why are you doing this? You'll just be disappointed. I'm like, I don't care. I'm willing to be disappointed because getting a bigger building for Lungri Tampa Centre is worth it. And so I was disappointed. We searched for 4 years for this place. And I would be regularly in tears because we'd find somewhere and we'd lose it and I'd cry and I'd think it's the end of the world. And then after about a week, I'd pick myself up again and we'd go through the whole thing again. And so I was just happy to suck it up. I knew all of the devastation wouldn't kill me, but it was because it was so clear to me that we had to get a bigger building or Lungri Tampa Centre would close. So, yeah, I was quite shocked by people thinking the fear of disappointment is enough to stop you. Yes, so that can be a big driving force, but is it? No. And I've come across people like that. I've also read stories of great sportsmen that have had that thing of the drive to show others, to show them up. And it's much easier to fight against something than for something. But it can trip you up. It can also trip you up. There's a great show on SBS called They Came From Nowhere about soccer. Have you seen that? It's a two-part doco about this real underdog soccer team from Western Sydney. It's absolutely rip-roaring documentary. And their main motivation was because they were underdog. And so then when they started getting success, well, they fell apart. So the question with this, with the worldly concerns, is you think, okay, of all the things that we're doing that matter to us in our life, and of all these things of the worldly or the unstable kind of unreliable concerns, what's the ratio that we put in to just trying to adjust our comfort levels or trying to make sure that people just think well of us? No, it's terrible, isn't it? So then the kind of result that we get from that, well, of course we're kind of struggling. the ratio of time spent on the worldly concerns, and even like from a Buddhist point of view, this is the biggest thing. This is the difference between being on a path to liberation and enlightenment or being stuck in the worldly concerns. And it seeps into everything. So in your workbooks, there's a few questions there about the things that are important to you. It's like the second yellow sheet. What are the things that matter most to you? But then what are we doing each week that actually contributes to them? Because most of each week we're doing these things. So it's like we've got our dreams and we're not connecting to them. Yeah, well, if your dream is to be admired or approved, it'll never be enough, will it? I mean, this is where we see the extremes of influences. It's like you're creating your own prison. So you get the short-term goal, but why it's called worldly concern is that you have to keep on sustaining it. It's unreliable, and one thing can go wrong and you can lose the lot. And of course people do. Eventually you lose the lot, and so you lose the fame and you lose the reputation. We see this with the downfall of famous movie stars and things. And so then they also lose their mind. They lose their sense of worth. And he found books. Yeah, there's a couple of docos. There's one of I think a famous swimmer as well, and he became a drug addict. And yeah, that's such a revealing documentary. He was so brave and honest in that. And so that's this thing of how at first, when you do have all the accolades and everyone tells you fantastic, you have the cognitive fusion, you believe your publicity. You think, I am that. You start believing it. And so then you open for manipulation, but then it can also... And of course, so many artists and composers were just hated when they were alive. That's right. Their husbands' names. Yeah, so with that, in a way, the writing the book or the music, not getting the accolades, having it under your husband's name, in a way it keeps you really honest because you're just doing it for the work. So for you personally, you're doing it for the work, even though your whole life's pretty difficult. Yeah. You're not doing it for people to like you. Because I noticed that also with the costume making. The moment I started making costumes because I wanted people to like the costumes, they'd be no good. I had to have the courage to just do the actual costume. So this comes down to then the power of a good motivation. So how do we overcome these worldly concerns? Is to bring this awareness to our motivation. So a really strong, clear goal in our mind, and start analyzing what our goal is, because I think there's many layers of it. And so when we think how we go through the day, what gets us out of bed in the morning, if you just kind of barrel out of bed and go, oh my God, I'm late, and off you go. There's not much intention there. So what do you think the direction of the day, how it will go? It'll be, you need a cup of tea. That's right. You might spend the whole day trying to get that cup of coffee or tea. You might be in a bad mood, or you find you've gone through a whole day and it's just gone. What else propels us into the day apart from, oh my God, I need a cup of coffee or tea? Why do we even get up? Pay the bills. That's the habit. Why else? What's motivating us? Yeah, so again, money is a, there's cognitive fusion there because we think money equals good. Health and movement, so that's getting a bit more sustainable. But again, it's for why, isn't it? So why do we want health and movement? Yep. And why do you want to engage in life? It's like we've got to get we the thing is to start asking why. So you ask why? Yay, that's right. That's right. So I mean I get lost in the details. So I often wake up going, oh my God, I've got to do all the LTC emails that I'm procrastinating about. Or else, oh, I've got to prepare for some wonderful class that's coming up. But that's not enough. It's got to be why. Why am I doing that? Yeah, well, so it's to so that okay, I want to be able to lead a good class, but why? That's right. The purpose has to be greater. So it's got to, it can't just be, I want to lead a good class because I don't want to look like an idiot. That's right. So then it's like, so I'm doing it for others. And so then if I do look like an idiot, it doesn't matter. I can relax because it doesn't, that's not the point. So it gets me over my stage fright and my nerves. So the other thing, so then you go, okay, if from a Buddhist point of view, you go even, well, why doing it for others? So it's not just as a band-aid measure here. It's like, it's to give you the tools to become liberated from suffering forever. So then, once I've got to that point, it's a really big picture. Then I'm not procrastinating anymore. Then doing the emails is a cinch. But if you just go, oh, I have to do the emails and leave it at that. Yeah, so this is a thing. So if you couldn't do those things, yeah, you might think, yeah, it could be devastating. So again, it's because you haven't gone in deep enough of why. Because if one day I can't lead a class, like I lose my voice, for instance, do I also lose my purpose in life? So there's got to be other ways. If the reason I'm doing it isn't to lead a class, but it's actually to help people become liberated, then I just find a different way to help people become liberated. So this is a thing that happens with athletes. They do the thing and then no, they can't physically do it anymore. Now what? So we've got to keep asking why. So even for living a good life, being healthy, again, it's why. And so if we're thinking, oh, so at the minimum, to be a positive contribution to the world, then that becomes the bigger thing. And so then if for a few days we have a terrible life, it's okay because we can still be have a contribution to the world. Yeah, so that's right. There's people, some people who experience disability like that, they don't let it beat them. They don't let them stop doing what's really important. But there's a lot of work that to get that, to get to there. So when we're asking why, you just keep asking and you've got to include the benefit for yourself and for others. Yes, so you've got all the tricks of how to get there, but what makes it flow is having this deeper purpose. So even if you think, oh my God, I've got to clean the house. So I personally think that urge to clean the house is actually an urge to clarify your mind. And so by decluttering the house, you help declutter your own mind. But if you just stop it, I've got to declutter the house, then you're going to get really cranky when someone comes in with their muddy boots or leaves their stuff everywhere, and now you haven't got that decluttered, calm mind. So even just worldly things, just doing ordinary daily things, we're not going to get on with people if we just leave it at that basic thing. Whereas if we go, oh, I've got to clean the house, well, why? Declutter my mind, make a nice environment as an offering to everybody that comes, all of those things. If you clean the house just because you're having visitors and you want to present yourself well, and maybe one day you get caught out and the visitors come and they go, oh, I don't know about the state of your house. And so then the question, so what would you be doing right now if you knew you could not fail? So this wonderful question comes from just some random post on Facebook, and it just struck me between the eyebrows. I just thought, this is a question for me. And if something comes to mind, take note of what that would be. So when we're looking at our motivation, then there's a couple of ways that we can analyze our motivation. There's causal motivations, which is the, kind of like the internal causes, what drives us. And then, and that's kind of what gets us out of bed in the morning and motivates our life. And it might be, I'm going to show them, I'll prove them wrong. That can be a motivator for years and years. To prove our parents wrong can be a huge motivator for years and years. And it colors everything that we do. Or it can be that I just want to make the most of my life and not waste my life, or I want to be able to help others in some way. So the causal motivation, and this one we can adjust, we can think about it, we can bring our intention to it. Then during the day there's the momentary motivation. This is where we're a bit reactive. Things happen and we respond. So that's colored by what's driving us in our life. And so what this means is that it's not actually what we're doing in our life, it's why we're doing it. So we don't have to go and cure malaria or do all those big ticket things. We can do what looks like fairly inconsequential, but if we've got a good why, it's going to make a huge impact on ourselves and others. So from a Buddhist point of view, the altruistic intention, the bodhicitta intention, is the causal motivation for everything, for cleaning the house, for doing the emails, for getting out of bed, for not getting out of bed. For going, not today, I'm not doing it. You can still do it with bodhicitta, with compassion. You can have the flu with compassion and altruism. You can have success with compassion and altruism. You can have the lot. Various kind of motivations from a non-religious point of view, looking after your family, those that you're responsible for, contributing, giving back to our society, protecting the vulnerable, looking after them, those that cannot help themselves, paying it forward, all the kindnesses that have brought us up and brought us to this part of our life, sharing that on. Today I'm going to try to benefit whenever I can, and at the very least I will not harm. So that should be our basic motivation. We can do that. We don't even have to have a formal meditation practice. We just think that before we get out of bed. Everything's covered in that. So if we start off like that, then when things go wrong throughout the day, we won't get derailed. And we won't have to put all that energy into reminding ourselves what we're doing here, because we're already in the right direction. So setting the motivation in the morning is really, it's a pretty amazing life hack, actually, because trying to set your motivation in the middle of doing something already in the middle of the day takes a huge amount of effort to run out of energy. Whereas if you readjust every morning, it sets you off in that direction and it just happens smoothly. You don't have to keep reminding yourself all the time. The other thing about setting your motivation from a Buddhist point of view, it's a little different from psychology. So in psychology, you have your motivation, then you've got your unconscious one. That's the bad one. And so you might think, oh, I'm trying to be a good person. But really, I'm not. So you're second-guessing yourself all the time. And it's not like that in Buddhism. It's whatever we bring our attention to. So we have all of these currents from the worldly concern that push us around until we become aware of them. And then we just adjust it and go, well, of course I want to be happy. Yeah, that's a good starting point. And then we deepen it, we make it altruistic, and we pull all the pieces together. Until we've got an altruistic motivation, then we go out and have the day. And then we can trust ourselves how we're going to respond. So before I get into a couple of really juicy examples, any other questions or comments about this, setting our motivation and not being overwhelmed by our attachments and aversions? Okay, let's have a look at functional and dysfunctional motivations. So here's one for sexuality. So we've got for a healthy type of motivation, causal motivation and momentary motivation. So in a good relationship, the causal motivation is just really sincere. It's like, you know, a connection with another human being, to be an authentic human being, to care about each other, that you have you have what's called, you know, joyous empathy. You're happy when they're happy. And in terms of sexuality, you've also got to have a bit of lust, otherwise you'd never hop into bed. But, you know, any kind of relationship, a causal motivation that includes just the benefit of oneself and the other. So the dysfunctional way, though, is that the causal motivation, what's driving us, might be just hedonistic pleasure. So we're not caring about the other person. It's just all about me. It could be that we need to have a sense of power over others. We need to be reflected and adored by others, or it could just be neediness, fear of being alone. So all of these are powerful motivations, driving factors with people. And where it gets us into trouble in relationships, that how these appear at the beginning is if the momentary motivation, you could be really nice. You could be quite romantic. You get on. But what's driving it underneath are these dysfunctional kinds of ways of being. And so this is why so many times you might get into a relationship and the first few months are fine because it's all nice and romantic. That's the momentary motivation. It's quite easy. But it wears off, and then what's really driving us? And I think then with sexuality too, so then you might be lovers with someone and then feel quite alone, even disgusted with your partner. Quite hollow and alienated. And of course, we don't have any education about this in school, about how to have a good relationship, how to be friends, how to be lovers, how to be parents, none of this. So how people get their education, of course, mostly is through porn. So there's a fantastic, I'm not sure if I put it in here as the homework, should have put it in. There's a great movie called Don John. Have anyone seen that? Fantastic. Who's the famous actress? Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And he's totally awesome actor. He produced it, directed it, wrote it, and starred in it. And then Julianne Moore is the woman, and is just fantastic. So watching that movie was what brought all of this up for me to put it together. And it just explained how come so many of my relationships went wrong. Why they were not sustainable. You're just not that into you. Yeah. So the other one, say becoming a doctor, something that takes a huge amount of effort, time, investment, resources, the whole thing. The healthy reason to become a doctor, to help others. You'd think that's why people would become a doctor. That's not why most doctors become doctors. Most doctors become doctors because they got good marks at school and their parents pushed them into it. And if they can't get that, then they do veterinary science. If they can't do that, they do dentistry, isn't it? So, diagnosis. Unlike nurses, yes, that's right. Yeah, because there's not the fame and the status and the kudos and everything with the nurses. So, it keeps you honest. So, the wish to help, the wish to alleviate suffering, and then what gets you through doctor's school, of course, when you're doing years of statistics and whatever and exams and stuff, and you're not helping anybody, but you're thinking of the long term, how to help. So momentary, yeah, you've got to aim to pass your exams, but what's driving you is this looking forward to being able to help others. However, I've been to some atrocious doctors in my time, and I started thinking, why on earth are you even doing this? You don't even like humans. And so why? Because status, money, the whole thing, the car, the community accolades. Or to satisfy one's parents, because of the pressure, the society pressure like that. And then the motivation in the moment. So this is what I found with I've actually had some doctors because I'm autistic, right? So I came up with some questions, but I wasn't smiling when I was asking the questions. So they thought I was like challenging their authority. And so this doctor said to me, don't you worry your little head about that. Believe me, just said that. And then he said, don't you know who you're talking to? And I'm like, well, no, I can't remember your name. Anyway, it was a complete disaster and he stormed out. And so I'm just like, how can this be? And how can someone with such an amount of power be so intimidated by me, a sick, stupid person? And so then I started thinking, okay, so because the causal motivation clearly wasn't to help someone, it was all of this status, that when someone's challenging it, it's like, how very dare you? So you think it's all fine until it's challenged. And so a lot of people in power are like this. They think everything's fine, and then someone challenges them and they just lose it. So always get a second opinion. So are you kind of getting an idea now how we can have a sincere, uncorrupted, you know, genuine human approach? And then it can get co-opted and corrupted by these emotional fears and needs, which in themselves aren't wrong. All those worldly concerns, they're not wrong. Where we make the mistake is where we look for them. So if we're needy, if we need to feel worthwhile, where do we look for that? We look for it in others. And that's just not sustainable. And our friends might keep on telling us all the time, yeah, we're fine, you're a great person, and we don't even believe them. Because we can't feel it. But what are the, on the yellow sheet, what are the questions for the second yellow sheet? One of that is to compose your own morning motivation. Yeah, does someone have a spare Is it habit of the worldly concerns? It's just, oh, okay. So, yeah, how to set your direction through life. So that's asking why. Oh, yes. And then the ones at the beginning. So, for instance, there's a question number four in there about a time where you voluntarily went through discomfort or suffering to do something that you love doing. Because even though we're overwhelmed by these worldly concerns, they don't overwhelm us all the time. There are some things that we love doing that we do happily go through difficulty for. So to start becoming aware of those and actually appreciating them, appreciating your efforts that way. Before we do our meditation, what comments or questions do you have about this, about our motivation, causal and momentary? Yeah, that's right. If you, an autistic doctor may not have the good bedside manner. Yeah, so there's, and especially with autism, it's what's called the double empathy problem. And so because we conflate someone caring by going, oh, and so if someone isn't demonstrating that, you think they don't care. Whereas actually, so there was this story, someone who had the flu and their partner was autistic, and that they were just saying they don't care at all. Like, they came in, they didn't even ask me how I was, they just left the suit there and they left without saying anything. And then they talked to the autistic person, and the autistic person's like, what how rude, I'm not gonna ask them how they are because it's so obvious. I'd never you know, and I didn't want to disturb them. I just put the suit down really quietly and I did it and left them there. So cognitive fusion does this thing that thinks it's got to look like what it is. But yeah, you just cannot tell how people are demonstrating. And so, yeah, all the smiley, lovely people, all you have to do is act like that and everyone thinks you actually are like that. It isn't necessarily true. Cognitive fusion is also where if someone is well presented in a suit and clean with good teeth, then you think they're legit. Yeah, and I mean, so many scammers are like that. Yeah, just to present that kind of thing. So the reason that we fall for it is because of this cognitive fusion and because of our being bullied by those worldly concerns. Yeah. Well, even like, so Lama Zorin Rinpoche, when he was giving teachings, he was a very unconventional teacher. So there wasn't a clear beginning, middle, and end. It wasn't all nicely packaged. It wasn't cleanly packaged. So people would come expecting Rinpoche to teach on Bodhisattva's way of life, verse 1, 2, 3, 4. They'd open their books. They'd be ready for dot point one. And Rinpoche just start telling a story. And so 3 weeks later, they're like, when are we going to start on the text? And it's like, baby, we've almost finished. It's just been coming across in a different way. So Rinpoche taught, he was not concerned with how he appeared to others. He taught from the heart to everybody who was in the room and cut straight to the chase. And we're so used to having everything packaged nicely that if it's not all schmick, then we don't even know how to listen to it. So I find movies from the old, you know, about the olden days, a lot, being eccentric was a lot more kind of accepted. And so you got over people's eccentricities and actually saw what they were on about. Let's do a short meditation. So take a nice deep breath, settle into the present moment. Allow your awareness to turn inward, observing the ebb and flow of your own experience. we can take a few moments to explore these persistent patterns that consume our mind often, the unstable concern. So first, imagine a seesaw constantly tipping back and forth between pleasant and unpleasant, pleasure and pain. One moment we're basking in all the joys of fine food and music and friends. The next we're recoiling from the sting of indigestion, drunken arguments, exhaustion. Just as a seesaw can never find perfect balance, our minds oscillate between grasping at what feels good, pushing away what's unpleasant. Turn your mind to your attention to, for instance, a game of Monopoly. You frantically acquire properties and wealth driven by fear of loss. But as soon as we think we've won the game, our hard-earned assets can be snatched away. Gain and loss, two sides of the same coin, forever in motion. And then cast your gaze to a weather vane spinning in the winds. Spinning in the winds of praise and blame. A light breeze of encouragement fills our sails, only to be followed by a gust of criticism that threatens to blow us off course. Our sense of self becomes tethered to the shifting opinions of others, never quite finding true north. And then finally, picture a spotlight on the stage. The focus of attention and adoration, basking in the glory of fame. But just as quickly the light can fade, leaving us in the shadows of disgrace. The stage of life, ever changing, alternating between the thrill of recognition, the fear of being found out, the pain of being forgotten. So these eight worldly concerns, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disgrace, they are persistent undercurrents of the human experience. And they target us, demanding our attention, feeding an endless cycle of attachment and aversion. Here in this moment, breathe deeply and observe these patterns with compassion. neither grasping nor rejecting. Simply witnessing the ebb and flow. And in this compassion, we can find freedom to live with equanimity, unbound by the winds of circumstances. So with this sense of stillness and stability, enjoying the ebb and flow, then we can dedicate our class and all the merits and effort to being able to live our life in an authentic manner, be true to what really matters to us, with the confidence of not being distracted, blown off course. And that way, make our life highly meaningful and beneficial for ourselves and others. Okay. So, just to summarize what we've looked at today, how our worldly concerns, preoccupation, distracts and corrupts all of the good things about us. It's why we get distracted. Attachment and fear makes us miss out on the things that we really care about and love. And cognitive fusion means that we're a slave to the belief that happiness comes from the thing outside, that the happiness is in the thing. So this is just step one of becoming aware of this. Just becoming aware of it in play in your life will loosen its grip. We don't even have to do anything about it, just becoming aware of it and not getting caught up. So the homework there are the reflection sheets and composing your own motivation, your morning motivation. So write one out for yourself, asking why, putting in everything that you do, all the things that matter in your life, health, movement, cats, birds, computers, coffee, the whole lot. Put it all in there. And then next week we're going to look at training for optimal flourishing. And what does that mean? It's called the Three High Trainings, and it's about our ethics, our focus, and wisdom or understanding. So these are the skills that we need to develop. So this week we've looked at what we've got to get rid of, and next week we're going to look at what do we actually need to become a flourishing human being.